Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the No Mind Podcast. This is Mitch Maxine. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Before we get going into today's topic, I want to remind everybody that if you've got any comments, questions, critiques, if you just want to swear at me, please feel free to post on the No Mind Podcast Facebook page. My personal page is also available for comment, or you can send an email to nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. Now that we've got that over with, I want to introduce today's guest. This is Mr. Lenny Stokes. He's coming to us all the way from Blessington, Ireland. Is that right, Lenny?
That's correct. Hey, Mitch, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing real well, my friend. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on today.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Today's topic, for those who don't know, is the pitfalls and the perspective of running a karate school as a business. I want to give you a little tiny bit of background about Len, and I'm going to let him chime in afterwards in case I've misspoken or missed anything. Started martial arts in the mid-80s, originally in kung fu training, before moving to traditional Kenpo in around 88. Got his black belt around 2002, opened his own school in 2005, and moved to running it as a full-time business in 2015. So it's been a few years, and perfect guest for today's topic because I really want to get into the notion of running a martial arts school as a business. So again, welcome, Lenny. And is there anything you'd like to add before we get going?
Well, first of all, I hope everyone can understand my thick Irish accent, because I know a lot of your listeners may be from Canada, so hopefully they can all understand me okay. I don't use any slang that kind of puts them off.
If I can understand you, I'm sure everybody can. I wouldn't worry about it.
And just to say, we met through, you came as a guest to my dojo one evening. You were here competing with Team Canada, and you guys you personified everything we're about, as inclusive martial arts in a dojo. We had a great session that night, and hopefully we can do it again soon.
I'll tell you the truth, that night at the dojo was one of the high points of that trip. I loved loved every second of it. It was awesome.
That's great. And likewise, it was great. We got to do it again soon.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Big time. Yeah, you called out some dates there, and I suppose as running martial arts a full-time business, to me it wasn't something that happened overnight. And it was a sequence of events over a long time that actually pushed me into it eventually. If you want to delve into anything you want to ask me, I'll give you the whole pathway through if you wish.
Honestly, look, as much as you'd like to tell us, I'd love to hear it, because I know very little about. And another thing I'm interested about too is my brother and I ran a dojo for a long time, a decade or longer, in downtown Toronto. And I'm curious about some of the cultural differences. I mean, we didn't talk about this in advance as a talking point.
Yeah.
For myself, I'd really love to hear about the process you went through to get to a full-time medium with your club, because like I said, I'm curious if there's any cultural differences.
Well, basically, as I said, I started off, took up martial arts in a kung fu school in the town I lived, a place called Tapa, which is in South Dublin, which is literally about 20 minutes from where I actually live now in Blessington. I studied that for a few years, the club folded up, and then through a friend of the family who taught traditional Kenpo, I took that up in the late 80s. And we probably get into this later on about difference of styles. Traditional Kenpo isn't a very to the fore style here anymore. I suppose globally, the American Kenpo kind of pushed in and took over and pushed us aside a little bit. Essentially, the core of our syllabus is traditional Kenpo, which started off with Chinese roots and then has Japanese roots after that. We have a lot of Chinese and Japanese terminology through our style. But we'll come back to that later. I trained under my own sensei, a guy called Aidan Burke, who was a friend of the family all throughout the 80s and 90s, and eventually achieved my black belt early 2000s, 2004, 2005. And at the time, he was pushing me at the time, because I was traveling bigger distance to his club at the time, that would I not branch out and open up kind of a sister club, that it was time to spread wings and go, per se. That, you know, I'd gone as far as black belt. Yes, he could take me forward. Yes, to where more katas I could learn, but the real essence of taking the next step was to pass on the knowledge then. So eventually took the plunge in 2005 and rented an old parish hall here in Blessington. Now, Blessington's a small village. Well, it's a small town now in the foothills of the Wicklow Mountains outside Dublin. Now, mountains to us is not what you get in Canada, by any means. A population at the time of about 4,500 people. And we started off predominantly only with adults. I had no interest whatsoever in teaching kids. I was just basically going on the model that I had learned from and the teachers that I had learned from. And we stuck solely at the time to traditional Kenpo.
Can I jump in and ask you a quick question, Lenny? You started off at the Kempo school, and you had said you got your black belt, and your instructor kind of nudged you to start your own club. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Geographically, where is your club, or at the time, where was your club versus the club that you originated?
Oh, gosh. It would be a good, as the crow flies, it's probably a good 15, 20 miles. In terms of where Blessington is a village on its own with no immediate amenities outside of the village. So, I mean, in terms of me setting up, it wasn't in any direct competition with where I had been previously.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very small satellite village in the countryside, basically. Yeah, so I opened up there. We basically trained twice a week for the guts of 10 years. And in that time, I was also a full-time firefighter and paramedic here. That was my full-time career here in Dublin. So I balanced between my shift work, which it was quite easy. But it was only we trained on Mondays and Thursday evenings. There was one Monday night in a month I was cut to work, and one Thursday night in a month I was cut to work. And there was other guys there with me who could take classes. And we basically, we went along for the guts of 10 years. About 7 years, 6, 7 years into it, I had one parent approach me, asking me would I teach kids. And I had no interest at the time. I said, no, I couldn't really commit to it because I knew there'd be bigger volume of kids probably come along and juggling shift work and so on. She basically pleaded and begged me. She had a daughter who had been involved in boxing, didn't like the full contact element of it. She was only 11 years of age. I mean, we didn't really have female boxing at the time. Katie Taylor, who's obviously to the fore here now, was really only young then. So there was no avenue for female combat sports as such. So I said, okay, we'll take her on. She could come for an hour on a Monday and see how she felt. And her parents would have to be okay with the fact she'd be training with adults. I think my youngest member at the time was about 16.
And she was how old at the time?
She was 11.
11, okay.
11 years of age. She's still with me to this day, and she's a phenomenal martial artist. Absolutely phenomenal.
It's awesome that she stayed with you over that time period. That's amazing.
And I mean, if she eats, sleeps, and breathes martial arts, she is just, oh my God. Yeah. We could do a whole podcast, and you could even get her on to speak some night.
That would be amazing. You know.
So I progressed along with that for a couple of years, and then the word kind of started to spread a bit that you're taking kids. And I was kind of, I don't know. And eventually, just talking to my partner, he kind of pushed towards it. Said, okay, well, let's give it a go. One of my senseis had just retired from work. He'd hit late 50s. He took early retirement. And he said, look, he says, I'll give you a hand. And the days you have to work your day job, I'll look after classes. So I said, okay, let's give it a go. We opened in 2022. We opened in 2011, I think it was. 2010, 2011. In the hope that I would have 25 kids. And basically, in the space of 3 years, we had 185 kids.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And what was the adult student population at the same time?
It was holding steady at a core of about a dozen to 15. In Ireland, martial arts is something, it's way down the pecking order in terms of sports. I mean, our two biggest sports are soccer and our Gaelic sports, which is Gaelic football and hurling, which they play with sticks. It's kind of ice hockey on a pitch, for want of a better word. And then you've got rugby, and then you've all got your kids' dance classes and so on. So martial arts would be way, way down the pecking order.
Before we go on, I really want to talk about that for a second, because it's that being down on the pecking order is something we're quite familiar with here in Canada as well, at least in Ontario. Hockey definitely takes probably one of the top two spots. And then everything else seems to take a higher priority. And there's a lot of sports and other activities that individuals and kids specifically are into. But I'm quite familiar with karate generally being lower on the pecking order.
Mm-hmm.
The population of Blessington. Oh,
yes.
First of all, let's start there. How many people are in Blessington?
Now there's about 7,000.
7,000. But at the time.
It was about 4,000, 4,500.
So out of a population of 4,000, you had a student population at the club, you said, of around, what was it, 185 or something?
185 kids.
Goodness gracious.
Now, that was over a period of time. We started off with 30 and we just word of mouth.
Now, the other question, because that's insane, that number is insanely high for any of the martial arts schools in and around the area that I train or that mm-hmm. we associate with. That's crazy high. So I want to poke in a little bit and try and figure out why, like, that's a very high percentage of the kid population of a 4,000 person town.
Yeah.
Were there then, or are there now, competing dojos in the same area?
The only comparable thing, well, other martial art per se, would have been Taekwondo. They had, I think, a student base of about 15, 20 maybe, and that was kids and adults.
Wow. Okay, I got to ask you, how do you, and for purely selfish reasons, maybe we can learn something from you here. How the hell did you get a student population and kids alone of 185?
I'm not sure if I can answer this, but not that I'm holding back any secrets. I'm not really sure what happened. Basically, I tried to market it with something that had a hook that was appealing to kids. Like, you can go out, you can put down karate, you can put down taekwondo or something. Okay, well, I'm appealing to a kid's base here. And something. So I said, we got to market this as something that's cool. So I named the kids section of the club. It wasn't Blessed and Kelpa Club. We called it Little Ninjas. And we got a little cartoon-like logo, and I burst this out as a flyer. And we marketed it as kids self-street defense and learn to be a little ninja. And we just put an ad in a local parish newsletter, which is delivered free to every home in Blessington every week, with the hope, I said, of 30 kids. It just erupted. Not really sure why.
You know, it's funny because, and I don't like to name other people on the podcast simply because I don't have their overt permission and I don't want to. The head instructor of the club I came up through the ranks with, whom you know and whom you've met.
Yes.
They did very much the same sort of marketing. They called it, ironically enough, Little Ninjas. They had a Little Ninja course.
Okay,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, there was ads done around town and that sort of thing. And we never, or that club, never even approached 185. That number just, it's mind-boggling to me. And let me ask you this, because again, maybe cultural differences have something to do with it. The club that you came from, is it still running? Is it still
going? It is, yeah. It's still going, yeah.
And what kind of student population do they have in terms of kids?
I'd say about 40.
That's still, like, 185.
That's a conservative guess towards the higher end.
Right. I still can't wrap my head around 185 kids. That number, 40, is a little closer in line to what I'm used to, but it's still really very much on the high side. It's fascinating to me that you've had that much. I mean, it's awesome, but it's fascinating to me that you've had that much success.
Maybe, and this is just a hunch, that maybe our location had a lot to do with it. People where I live don't want to travel too far out to go to activities. So they had their, we'll call it ball sports, soccer, GAA, Gaelic sports, so on. And other than that, there wasn't a lot. So this was something new for them. The other hook for us, and this actually became a huge thing for me, which I kind of found quite amusing, was the fact we wore a black gi. The amount of parents who went, oh, you wear black, that's so cool. And I was kind of, well, this is our uniform. It's always been our uniform.
Right, right.
And the kids just jumped on this amazingly. But whatever happened, it was just word of mouth, and it just sprout legs and just took off.
I'm fascinated by this, and I really want to, if you don't mind spending a few minutes.
No problem.
Kind of digging into this. I know you run several martial arts, or I know you welcome different styles and different martial arts. I'm assuming that this explosion of kids is specific to the Kempo corner of the business. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
It seems to be.
So I'm assuming you have gradings and graduated ranking system where start at white and you move up through the ranks. If you had to, and I'm sorry for hitting you with stuff that's completely not on our talking points.
No, it's no problem.
We haven't touched anything about the talking points yet. But this is what I love about the podcast. We just start talking and the conversation goes organically. So you have a ranking system, and obviously I assume you have requirements for each belt level.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. What kind of retention rate do you have? If a kid starts, obviously as a white belt, they walk in the front door, I want to take Kempo, and you say, great, come on in. What's the percentage chance that they will still be there after a year?
With us, we've got about a 75 to 80% retention.
You know what? I really think you need to start classes on how to run martial arts clubs. Because I don't know anybody with a student body that high with that high a retention rate. That's
really,
that's astounding. There's something that's going on that I'd really love to try and pinpoint, and I don't know how to do it without dragging this podcast into a 4 or 5 hour affair where I grill you on every single part of how you run that club.
Hey, we can do that some other time if you want, no problem.
Okay, so let's talk about this. And let's keep the conversation to kids for now, since we're talking about kids. I'm assuming, with the numbers that you've given me, that the majority of the income that the club generates is from kids.
Absolutely. It's my backbone.
that's something that I don't think is different here or among the satellite clubs that I associate with. Almost everybody pays the rent and makes whatever money they make with their kids' classes. So how do you perceive, and now we're going to start getting into the talking points a little bit, when you test a group of kids for whatever rank, is your perspective on grading tests, it's a foregone conclusion when a kid steps out on the dojo floor to test that you're already comfortable with their ability level and that you've already determined that they're going to pass? Or is it more of a, let's see how you perform during the grading and then we will determine after that whether or not you pass?
It's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B with us. And I will say this for our, we'll call it a syllabus. Our syllabus is constantly fluid, as we'll say. I'm willing to adjust it day to day, week to week, year to year, from what I'm seeing. And a lot of that is from influences from other martial arts. And I can come back to that in a while. Our kids start, the youngest kid we take in is 4.5 years of age. And that goes right up. Now, I'm sure this is probably commonplace with your own schools that you've dealt with. When they hit 12 to 15, becomes the sticky years.
Right.
Because they've got, you know, whether they stay or whether they go. And also at that stage, it's getting a lot more technical and we demand a hell of a lot more from them. So what we try and do is you try and nurture an enjoyment in it in the early years. Because if they're not enjoying it, they're not going to come back. So the structure of my class will be, okay, we line up traditionally as we do. We bow in, we've got a warm up, we've got a stretch. As much as we can in all Japanese terminology. And then I'll break the class, typically, say, a kid's class up to the age of 9, 10 years of age is 40, 45 minutes long maximum. We just don't get the attention span. And even that, we've come to realise that you'll get blocks of time retention out of them. So I'll do something technical, but then I'll plan some kind of game based on a technical ability. That could be anything from balance to a proper stance to having the moving stances between markers to reaction and so on and so forth. Simple stuff like that. And then we'll build the building blocks of, okay, I eventually want this kid to know this technique in a month's time. And it's going to involve, we'll call it a bow stance, and it's going to involve an inward block, and it's going to involve a reverse punch. And they will work on games and simple stuff in advance of that for a month. Where they think they're playing games, about two weeks out, we'll go, okay, this is why we're doing this. And then they start to learn the building blocks. So by the time it comes to... we've hit what's on the original syllabus. They've learned it in a kind of roundabout way, and it's not just standing there, repetition, by the time it comes to grade, the point I'm making is they are ready for, I won't put them out to grade unless they are ready to grade, which can be a very big bone of contention when you get one kid who picks up quicker than another kid. And then parents come along and go, Johnny's going for his yellow belt. My Brian isn't. I mean, my Brian's here 2 months longer. Why? And it normally gets into the conversation, but eventually ends up me saying, I'm basing my opinion on 35 years involved in martial arts. What are you basing yours on?
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I don't get that blunt really quickly. Like, I talk them through the process. And we have a lot of information. When kids come to club, we have an orientation day for parents. And I explain to them all, your kid is a piece of popcorn. Some pop straight away. Some take ages to pop. At the end of the day, they're all a piece of popcorn. They'll pop eventually. Trust us. We know what we're doing, and they'll develop at different stages. So in answer to your question, it's a little bit of, are they ready or are they going to perform on the day? Yes, they have to be ready, and I won't put them out until they are ready. That being said, no matter what age they are and no matter what grade they're going for, I will cover their grade requirements, but then I will always throw in ad lib. How do you cope with this?
Sure.
And I'll throw something. Could be anything. It could be something simple from, I'm going to throw a ball at you. What are you going to do? Are you going to block it? Are you going to catch it? Are you going to get out of the way? How are you going to stand? And we kind of discussed this with the other senseis in the club. And I have to say, I have an amazing team with me. And I think that's what makes it work as well. Because I don't know if that's answered your question. I just sent you in circles there.
No, you know, it's brilliant what you're saying. And I'm really, really quite enjoying hearing how you structure things. I've got a couple of more questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You made a reference earlier to, you know, you'll say, I'll take a particular student and I want him to learn this and we'll approach it by doing that. Is that to imply that you develop a training plan for each student? Do you separate the students that markedly and say, this student needs work here, so we're going to work this, and this student needs work in a different direction, and we're going to do that? Or is it more of a blend during the classes while still trying to pay attention to individual student needs?
It starts off as the latter there, Mitch, in that it's a bit of a blend at the start. However, as you go on, say, a few weeks, few months into training, I'm sure you can see with all students, some kids will pick up stuff quicker. Some kids will, you know, end up, they stay as the baby giraffe and roller skate, so they're still not picking it up. And at that stage, we change them around. We've got classes in the afternoons on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. On Monday evening, we have what we would call our more advanced class. And by more advanced, we mean not necessarily age, but it's more ability. So if someone's shown a particular aptitude of moving well, we take them out, we take the parents, listen, they're going to move, and this is why. And then what we try and group together then as much as we can in the other classes, kids of similar ability and age in a certain kind of, obviously you're not going to get everybody the same age, but as best you can. And you say, okay, this group here, they struggle with stances. Okay, let's work with these on stances and get them moving. This group right. here, they've got stances, their movement's okay, but their blocks are you know, need work, or they can't master the fundamentals of a proper roundhouse or whatever. And
sure.
So that's what I said earlier. We're constantly we're adapting all the time, and it's not sticking 100% to a curriculum, which I would have come up on, and maybe you would have when you had your syllabus of techniques, katas, so on and so forth. And the goal was to learn these, reproduce these, and have your technique in a certain way that it would be competent enough to be technically proficient to execute all these. And I've kind of not sidestepped away, but I've come at it from a different angle that, you know, it needs to be built differently for a lot of kids.
I want to dial back for a second and touch on something you had spoken earlier about, which I think is absolutely critical, which is the team of other instructors that you have working with you. And you had mentioned what a great group they are and how supportive of the process they are. Just to touch on that for a second, if I can ask, just as far as the Kempo goes, how many instructors do you have?
Oh, God. Okay, let me count.
That many? Wow.
Well, yeah, see, I started out just with two of us. And then I had guys who had been training with me in my previous club had come up to maybe brown belt level and so on. I have no problem, once they're teaching correctly, of being an instructor. You know, no matter what grade you are, if you're technically proficient to teach to a good green belt standard, you can teach kids to green belt standard, but as long as you're keeping your own skills set up. So every instructor I have with me now, with the exception of one, is someone I have brought through the system myself.
Right.
So they know the way I teach, they know what I like. Now, that sounds very conceited, I suppose, and very kind of, you know, what I want, but it's not. I mean, our dojo is very much a family, is the way I look at it. We're only as good as the sum of the parts. So I've got myself, would be the senior instructor, and then I've got Brian, Gary, Colm, Shauna, Flavio, Adam, Alan, Keith, and Will. We've got 10 of us on the team.
Wow. Basically. And do you have different instructors who are responsible for specific class times? Yeah, so each instructor or various instructors, you would say, okay, you're responsible for this class, and on a consistent, ongoing basis, that instructor runs that class.
I am there at every single class.
Really? Okay.
Wow. Every single class, and I would be the overseer. Now, what I'm actually trying to do, and you mentioned in your discussion points about succession along the way for building for the future and so on. I'm trying to, in some respects, not take a back seat, but let them do more and me step back a bit. Because
right.
they're the future of the dojo. I'm 50 years of age now. Eventually, you're going to start stiffening up. And you know, we're not going to do it forever.
Hey.
So these are the future of the club.
I'm hitting 60 this year. You don't have to tell me about
it. Well, you don't look it, man. You don't look it.
Yeah, I'll take that and run with it. But I like my brother and my ex-wife and I, we run a business, nothing to do with the martial arts. But none of us are getting any younger, and we're starting to think about it in terms of succession planning for the business as well. Now you're letting them kind of take more of the lead. But I'm assuming that as the senior instructor, if you want to use the term, the head instructor, you still set the tone in terms of ongoing, how the goals of the club sort of play out day to day, right?
Yeah, and it's something that I probably should have been more proactive in, that a lot of it in the early days, because it took off as it would be, just backtracking slightly, we got our 185 kids and we very quickly outgrew a parish hall in that we were paying for rent was grossly more than we could have got rented a commercial premises for, which is what we did in the end. I picked up a knee injury that put me out of work in the fire service, and then long story short, I was out, took early retirement and set up full time and discovered a miracle cure, which we can talk about again for my knee injury, that got me back fully mobile again. So I was able to dedicate 100% of my time to martial arts. Sort of. But because it took off so quickly, and in the early days there was two of us at the start, a lot of it I was running week to week on paperwork and so on and so forth. Until I hit a couple of years in, I went, hang on a second, this is a proper business. I need to run this property. Right. I'm getting swamped here. And at that stage, I had junior and senior students coming through the system who were coming on board to the kind of teaching age and had an interest in teaching. I would set the tone, but of those 10, there's 5 to 6 of them would have come through my whole ethos and how I set the tone in the class and the way we run the class and so on. They're almost a shadow of me at this stage. That I could, if I'm not there, I'd say, listen, Alan, can you take class now? And I know he'll run it exactly as I would want it run or how I would run it. Right.
Let me ask you a question just in broad terms. How important do you think it is? How much of the success, and I think it's fair that we can call your club a commercial success. I mean, any club that can pay the rent and provide the instructor or instructors with a consistent paycheck is successful. So let's call your club a successful business. How much of your influence as the head instructor do you attribute to the success of that club? I would think quite a bit.
See, it's hard to answer that without sounding vain, though, isn't it?
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right. It is, but I know you well enough to know you're not a vain individual. So let's put concerns like that aside. I'm genuinely curious. I happen to think that a single-minded, well-established, and by that I mean technically proficient head instructor is a critical component to a successful club. I'm curious what your thoughts about that are.
100%. But a huge thing comes down to people skills as well.
Absolutely, sure.
And I think a lot of parents in particular, and there's local forums here on social media, you'll see parents asking, I want to send my kids to a martial arts school. Who would you recommend? And our club pops up 99.9% of the times. And most of them are, I'll send it to Len. Len is great with the kids. Len is this. So maybe it's something to do with me. Maybe I'm just a good people person. My other half says I can just, you know, I have a golden tongue in terms of to speak to people. Yeah, it's being inclusive and listening to people's needs and wants, balancing that with what you need and want, and trying to find something that's going to work for everybody without compromising your own standards.
And there's a key point, without compromising your own standards, because I'll be perfectly honest, a lot of the clubs that I associate with or that I've had experience with absolutely compromise their standards. And I know that their standards at one time were high because I've trained with these people. I've spoken to them at length about martial arts. Some of the people I'm talking about are people who will sit, have a couple of drinks, and right along with me bemoan the standards of martial arts in our area. It's so poor. Why are we getting such an influx of black belts who really are not up to snuff in a technical sense? And yet these are the same people who will turn around and promote students without technical proficiency up through the rank. And that, to me, is really the tipping point of this conversation and why I really wanted to talk to you about this. Not, don't get me wrong, I've
No.
I want to talk about all of it, but this point, it really is a sticking point for me. How well, and again, this is a tough question to ask and maybe a tougher one to answer. You have your technical standards. I've had a little teeny brush with those standards when I got to train with you guys that night. And that was, as far as I understand it, as I recall, that wasn't even a karate class. That was there was a lot of martial arts influence in the class, but it was more of an aerobic style workout.
Yes. Yeah.
I've only brushed very superficially up against your standards, but I've seen the stuff online. I've talked to our mutual friend, and I have a great deal of respect for your level of standards, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast. How do you maintain a high level of standard and at the same time keep such an incredibly high retention rate for your student body?
We basically make it quite clear from the outset that this is a long road. If you want to get to senior black belt, and we have got to the stage with our syllabus that we split it, you've got a junior black belt and a senior black belt. Anyone from 15 down can train for the junior black belt. It's a tough grade even to get to that. It's a 7 to 8 year trip, and after that you're talking another 4 to 5 years for your senior black belt. And you can kind of, I won't say dilute things or let things go a little bit more, but in the younger lower grade belts, it's small progressions. And yes, the kids, I know people would, and I'll hold my hands up and say this, people say you're probably rewarding them too much too soon. I find they thrive on confidence. Whereas the syllabus may say they must do X, Y, and Z. I'm like, okay, if they got X, Y, and a half a Z. But I know in the next 3 years I'll iron out Z.
That's a really, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but
yeah, no, sure.
Again, you hit on a really, really key point there, because I've seen and have been a part of clubs where we would have the same sort of situation where we test somebody for a particular rank and we say, well, you know what, they got A and B okay, but C's awfully weak. And then we say, you know what, we'll just make sure we work with these guys to bring C up to snuff. And I think where a lot of the clubs who do that fall down is they don't follow up and work on C. So you've got now a student who's been put into a different circumstance as far as their ranking goes. They've been moved up a level. The expectations are higher, but they're not being given the tools by the teaching team to meet that expectation. They didn't meet it at the grading. The black belts said among each other, among themselves, we will work with this individual after the grading to bring them up to speed. But that's the part that doesn't really happen. There's no specific attention paid to bringing the student up to that level.
That throws back to earlier what I said, that we won't go for grade unless they're ready. Now, if A and B have fallen down, or A and B are good and C hasn't worked, you ain't going for your next grade until C is ready, and then add in the D, E, and F that you need as well.
Can I ask you a question? Do you have a formal way of making sure that you keep track of what these individuals need to work on as they move up through the ranks?
100%. And it's a software package, believe it or not.
That really?
Yes. Well, so when I said when the club erupted and I realised I can't keep track of this on pen and paper anymore, I met by chance with a guy from the UK who subsequently, sadly, we lost touch with in recent years, but that's a whole other story. But he introduced me to a software package called Club Manager Central. And this thing is a database and it does absolutely everything for you. It takes a roll call for you at every time everyone attends class. Everyone's got their own personal profile on it. You've got your own ID on it. And everyone's got a journal on it. And basically, when everybody does a grade, you input onto their journal what grade they've passed and any notes that need to be worked on. So next time it comes to a grade, I say, okay, who's grading this week? Okay, we've got Mitch, we've got Brian, we've got Jason, so on and so forth. Let's open up their journals. But I'm not going to say this week, but who's coming for a grade in the next couple of months? Okay, what have we got to work on? Okay, Len here, he's got to work on a sidekick. Mitch's got to work on his roundhouse and so on. So, okay, that's what we got to focus on for this lot. And we make them quite clear, okay, this wasn't quite what we needed the last time. This is what we got to work on. Without that package, I'd be lost, because it's just, it even does my accounts for me.
Okay, I've got another question for you.
Yeah.
Take all the time that you spend doing activity relative to the club. What percentage of that time is actually spent teaching, and what percentage of that time is doing anything else? Would it be a 50-50 split between admin work and actual teaching, higher, lower?
On average, it's about 50-50. That being said, at certain times of year, obviously when you've got grades coming up and so on, there's a hell of a lot more admin, or if you're doing some marketing, sometimes it can work out 70-30 on the admin side of things. Which is ironic that you say that, because I'm actually coming to the stage now where I'm looking to take on some people to help me with this side of it.
It's lovely speaking to somebody, honestly, who understands the breadth of what it means to run a business and apply that in a martial arts framework, because it's rarely seen. There's a couple of other questions I really do want to ask you.
You go for it, yeah.
One of the thoughts that is running through some martial arts discussion circles is that when you run a martial arts school as a for-profit business, which you certainly do, maintaining technical standards has to take a back seat to keeping your students or your student body at a certain level in order for you to pay the rent. Now, it seems like you've struck a reasonable balance in terms of being able to do that.
Yeah.
So at what point do you think a student becomes a customer? What do you feel about that balance? How do you address that through the way you run the club? And I know we've touched on this a little bit.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not making you repeat yourself.
No. And it's probably the only reason, well, one of the biggest reasons we lose people, is that maybe there's a gripe over value. Not value for money, but I'm paying you this money, I'm not progressing as quick as I want to. And I said, I think the way we try to combat that is we try and set it out at the start. Your kids are here. The younger ones, they'll learn it all based on fun and games at the start. They'll get to an age there, it's going to get more technical. And in that, they're going to move to the higher class. And then the aspiration there is move to the higher class again, and then to the senior class. If they're still with you at that stage, and that's why we structured our syllabus, and it's ever changing, is that I'm constantly looking for ways we need to keep this interesting. we need to keep it fun. A kid has to walk out here at the end of the day, I had so much fun today.
Right. Because
then they remember that's happy and their parent isn't a customer. My kids are having so much fun, money be damned. I think it's a balance of keeping so much interest that they don't get into that mindset. When they get older and they hit those teen years, and at that stage we're putting more pressure on them technically and watching maybe their peers progressing, what we do is if ever we have a showdown grade, which is rare enough because for a senior one it's about a 14-year journey, and the showdown grade it's grueling, I will be honest with you, and we're kind of a little bit cruel that we kind of every time we do one we try and make it a little bit harder, which is probably unfair to those who've gone before. We insist on that the kids are coming up to that 10, 11 to core group into 15 years, we make sure to come and watch it. This is what you have to aspire to. Most of them leave the place absolutely awestruck. The other thing we've incorporated, and again, we took it up from our colleague that we met through the UK, was we would have had no weapons katas or weapons demonstrations, but we took 4 basic weapons, and for the kids, we put it in as an extra add-on. If you'd like to try some weapons, we're going to do a workshop this weekend on the katana, we're going to do a workshop on the nunchaku, we're going to do a workshop on the bow staff, and we just have basic stuff. Well, I get to use the sword, I get to use the staff, you know,
right.
So on. Now, it's a little bit cliched, it's a little kind of a hook, but in that, we'll insist on proper technique, we'll insist on proper stances, we'll insist on proper application. It piques their interest a bit more, and that the parents don't feel purely like a paying customer. As I said, when they get to teenagers, when it gets really technical and they're coming towards their junior black belt, 13, 14, 15, and we're really putting the pressure on them, that's the main point, the time that we will get parents who get pissed off saying they haven't got their black belt yet. I mean, not normally 9 times out of 10, a fairly detailed chat with the parents will explain what's been involved. We've detailed it from day one, and look, this is the standard they've got to achieve. We've recorded our last few showdown grades that we can show them, and it's not a question of when are they going to get it, it's when do they want it and when are they going to work for it, because they'll all hit that little time where, and I'm sure you've encountered it over the years, anyone can get progressed through a system to become to brown belt, but to be a black belt, you have to want it and you have to work for it.
There's a phenomenon that we bump into quite often, and it's immediate gratification. Someone wants something and they want it now, and I find it to be a very North American concept. I'm just wondering, how much of that immediate gratification do you bump into with your students, where I want what I want and I want it right now and I'm just not willing to wait?
Funny enough that you'd ask that, that has become more prevalent in recent years. You know, some of my instructors say it's because of the snowflake generation.
It pains me to hear that it's become more prevalent over there, because it's always been that way here. My perception is that we've always had that issue. People aren't willing to wait. You're right. It has become more prevalent in recent times.
It's probably the biggest cause of me losing anyone. That and the fact that you get to a stage where the parents are going, oh, they have a black belt, they're paying us money and they're coming every week and they're not progressing. Kids, I think, not just kids, but people have accessibility to things a hell of a lot easier now. And I don't want to sound like, oh, back in our day.
I mean, it's kind of hard not to, though.
Exactly. It is a little bit of that. I mean, we in the early days, it's something simple like participation medals. We were hounded, you know, give them. And I was for a couple of competitions way back in the early days. Yeah, and I went, hang on a second, no.
Right.
I'm not doing this, you know. But, you know, you learn most from what you do wrong, I suppose. I'm not saying it's wrong, but for me, looking back, it wasn't the right thing to do.
I'll say it, it's wrong. One of the things my instructor instilled in me from very early on, karate, the way we trained at our dojo, was a microcosm of life. The things that happen to you here in this dojo will reflect on a much smaller scale the things that happen to you in your life. And it will
100%.
One of the draws is that it will teach you how to deal with those situations.
You're going to encounter kids who, I'm sad to say, will never win in competition. But we have, just as an aside, we've found ways to kind of help them a bit in that. We would generate a team competition. So we'll take a couple of strong students, a couple of middle students, and a couple of weaker students, and we put them on a team. And they'll fight a freestyle fight, and we've got a team of judges, and they're scoring every point scored. All the points add up to the team score. If a team can collectively, you can have your stronger guy can score 20 points, and you might score 1, but they might outscore your team collectively. So it gives them a better chance on a stronger, on a team to win. I mean, we took the kids abroad to an international competition 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
For a lot of them, it was their first time in competition, and they were nervous as hell. They were going into an arena the next day with 300 or 400 people, and I stood the night before and I said, look guys, some of you are going to win tomorrow, some of you aren't going to win, but I said, 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, you're going to be sitting at a job interview where your nerves are in your throat. And you can say, when I was 7 years of age, I walked out into a floor and I did a kata, or I walked in the floor and I fought against somebody. If I can do that, I can get you the nearest with job interview. And right. That's, to me, martial arts is building blocks for life. It's not for just sure. Getting out and putting on a gi and a belt and, you know.
Absolutely.
Trying a few shapes.
Let me ask you another question, if you don't mind, Len.
Yes.
You said you had a point where you hit 185 students. Where are you now, and is that still reflective of the numbers you have now?
Not quite. However, that's all due to the pandemic the last 2 years.
Right, yeah. COVID just changed everything. So.
Yeah, we had to go online for a long time, and we were lucky we had a lot. We lost a lot. That being said, we've been kind of open and closed, and I'm sure a lot of places are in Canada as well in the last 12 months. But we're back open now, and we're building again, and we're up to about 120, 125 at the moment.
Right, wow.
Now, that was without any marketing. I actually ran an ad today that we have vacancies in certain classes, and I've already had 22 uptakes today.
There is something going on that is drawing people, if it's the novelty because you don't have a lot of martial arts in your area, if it's something more intangible, I don't know what it is.
There's a couple of things I think Mitch attribute to it. One, as I said, we're a small community that people don't like to travel. It's an inconvenience to have to drive half an hour, 40 minutes to another town to find.
Sure.
There are very few fully equipped dojos in Ireland. Whereas we have a facility that's, you've been in, it's not huge, but we now have two floors. We've a downstairs and upstairs, two studios. It's fully matted, fully equipped. We've got a rack for heavy bags. We've got strike shields. We've got no end of equipment that we've built up over the years. So it's probably the only custom built, shall we say, dojo for miles and miles and miles. And the other thing I did was, it's not just a dojo, and without labouring the point too much, I obviously realised, okay, this place is there 24/7. There's only martial arts in it for so many hours a day. How else can we use this? And that's why I've brought in the Taekwondo Club was operating in an old parish hall, cold place that we operated for 10 years. It was freezing cold, no heating, no mats, no nothing. So I said, okay, come under my roof. You have full use of the facilities, rent off me. So I now have every martial arts club in Blessington and the West Whitler area operates out of Fight Fit Dojo.
So what you actually did was invite the competing club to come be a part of the structure that you already had in place.
Yes. And with that, I have a website. I've got social media. I said, you will be included in that as another club under this roof in the dojo.
It's funny. I got a comment on that. That's brilliant. I had a circumstance happen decades ago now where a young lady who trained at our club, she had since left and gone to a different club, both in the same geographic area. And she came to me and said, I have this idea. I want to run an evening of martial arts. We'll rent a hall. We'll invite all of the clubs in the local area to come. We'll have a dinner. We'll get some local businesses to sponsor it. We'll have some draws and prizes. But every club will put on a 15-minute demonstration. Basically, the only purpose behind doing it is to promote camaraderie among the different clubs in the area. And I thought, this is a brilliant idea. I loved the idea top to bottom. So we started doing it. We went out. We talked to every club in the area. Everybody was so enthusiastic, but there was this one club that flat out said, I want nothing to do with this. The only way my club will be a part of this is if we make it about my club. So this club presents martial arts and we will obviously be the center of the evening.
And egos.
Yeah, exactly. And she and I said, absolutely not. The whole point of this is to battle that, to fight that ego and to say, let's just get together as a group and appreciate what each other does.
100%.
And it was...
Sorry, no, I'll cut across you there. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please, no. Just to finish it off, we did it anyway without that club's involvement. It was amazing. It's one of my happiest memories in my martial arts career was being a part of that. And you've taken that one step further, not only accepting happily the competition that exists, but inviting them to be a part of your structure. I can't tell you the admiration I have for that.
Well, I've benefited from it in that, we've got myself, traditional Kenpo. We have a practitioner now who's moved to Ireland who comes from a Kyokushin background, who trains with us on our Kenpo syllabus, but who's also teaching us his Kyokushin. We've got somebody from Wing Chun. We've got our mutual friend who's Shitoru background, as far as I'm right with. Yeah. And then we've got a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club there. I said we've got a Taekwondo. We have a couple of K1 practitioners. And what I do now is we had our showdown grading for two students just before Christmas. I invited the senior instructors from all those disciplines. Please come along and see what we hold our showdown grade. And I asked all of them not to be part of the judging panel, but just to sit and give us their martial arts opinion in terms of what they deal with, what they see us doing. I suppose Bruce Lee was the flagship person in that. No one style was the only style. And, you know, you get so far in your own style of learning stuff and you go, what next? And I suppose me being pushed out to open up a club opened my eyes in terms of, you know what, there's a hell of a lot more out there. And let me, I want to learn. You know, I've hitched black belt. I'm on paper a third degree, but I know you've had that discussion previously. Mm-hmm. And to me, you get the show done. After that, it's just decoration in my mind because,
sure.
You know. And I don't want to belittle anybody who's gone higher in grades. That's not that's and that's one thing I'll never do is I try not to run down other martial arts because every martial art has something good from it. It wouldn't have been a martial art in the first place. You know, sure that there's parts of some I don't like, but I would never say, no, that's rubbish.
Let's talk about that for a second. And I'm going to just give everybody a heads up and you as well. This is going to be our last talking point. Cause
yeah, sure thing.
Just crossed the hour point and I know you have better things to do with your time. So
I'm Irish. I can talk all day, bitch. Well, that's without alcohol.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, this is not going to be the last time that I ask you to come on the podcast.
Absolute honor. Loved it.
So let's talk about that for a second, judging other styles and other forms of martial arts. Because I think we need to, I agree with you, every martial art has something to offer. If we look at it in terms of what are you going to do in a practical situation if you're taken to the ground? Well, I'll be perfectly honest with you, karate is not the best martial art to teach you how to deal with that circumstance. Yeah. There are far better. But I think we also need to delineate between good, structured, well-founded schools and schools who don't really care about anything except turning out students and making money. And
The McDojo, they call them here.
Exactly, the McDojos. Now, I will happily judge those types of clubs because, honestly, I think it's a disgrace when you see clubs that offer rank for time as opposed to proficiency, who value the dollars in their pockets above the skill levels of their students. So I agree with you that those other martial arts, everyone's got something to add to the picture. But I think we also need to delineate between clubs that are just poor clubs.
Yeah, you couldn't have voted it better.
So what do you do? Or have you run into a circumstance where you get a student who comes in who's had previous training, but it's obvious from their training that it was a substandard club that they trained at previously? Have you run into that circumstance?
Thankfully, not a lot. I have, not since I've opened my own dojo, no. But in the previous club I trained with, that I come up to my own black belt on it, I did, yes, encounter that a few times. Guys who had hit very, very high belt standards and then come in and were basically taken asunder by guys of lower belts in our club when he was into it. You could see this. I felt sorry for them because they were crestfallen.
Let me ask you another question related. What kind of weight do you lend to the notion of practical application? Is it more important to be able to defend yourself than it is to be able to perform a kata well?
Oh, good question. My mindset is probably biased in a little bit that our sensei, his buzzword was the street. If you can't win in a competition, but you get disqualified for heavy contact, at least I know you can defend yourself. That, and it was nearly his ethos. If you can't win, get disqualified. I'm not saying those were the exact words, you know.
Oh, my God.
And those weren't the exact words, but that was nearly. And I mean, if I may use a little bit of profanity, I mean, my sensei, Aiden, you would often hear him at competitions at a very, very loud voice, booming voice, and you would just hear, he always called me Leonard. It was never Len, it was all my full name. You just hear, Leonard, hit the bastard! And that was his ethos. So I'm kind of a little bit towards street defense and practical scenarios. Techniques, katas, I 100% understand the bunkai, the ethos of them, and why we have learned stances and why we have learned to stand and move in a certain way. It kind of arms me a little bit when somebody goes, hey, well, that's bullshit. That's not going to work in the street. I can say, yeah. But this stance engages your core, engages your hips. So when you throw a punch, it's not just a hand in motion. Your hips change from a horse stance to a bow stance. It says you're engaging your body. And this is why. And that's why boxers generate the power from the feet. And that's why you've got a deep stance here. If you repetition this way. So I insist on my cat as being immaculate. And I'll say this hand on heart, and I don't mean this to run down American Kenpo in any way, but I get very defensive and almost stress we are traditional Kenpo because we nearly lean more towards Okinawan teachings of traditional Japanese styles than what morphed, and sadly, I'll call a spade a spade, Americans commercialized it too much and they lost their stances, they lost application, and they're churning out black belts left, right and center, and you look at it going, it's actually you guys I feel sorry for, because you've got this black belt and it'll hold your trousers up, but you're in a practical situation, you're going to suffer, man.
You know, it's interesting. I'm loving this last, like I've loved the entire podcast, but this last few minutes, because my perspective is almost diametrically opposed to yours in that I don't train, I've never have trained with a practical application in mind. Whether or not I can handle myself in a practical circumstance, I don't know. I can't speak to that. Because frankly, I don't care. And my justification for that is I'm 60. I'll be 60 in a few months. Mm-hmm. I started training when I was 21. Most of my life has been spent following this particular avenue of study. In that time, I've gotten into exactly one fight. Now, I was a bouncer for a while, so I was in that situation. So I'm not counting that because that was my job, was to get physical. Yeah. My thought on it is, why would I spend so much time and money and effort and blood and sweat and tears learning how to do something that I'm very probably never going to have to actually do? And if I'm able to handle myself in that kind of circumstance, all the better. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And I don't look down on or denounce somebody because their perspective is more practically based. I think it's kind of all together. If you train well and you train hard and you train in a certain direction, you will have good technique. You'll have good kata. Yep. And you're also going to, as a byproduct, you'll be able to defend yourself should the situation arise.
What you're saying there probably personifies my ethos more. I probably came across as a bit this kind of gung-ho. Get out and defend
I love that if you can't win, get disqualified.
Yeah, I know. I don't preach that now, believe me.
Hang that up on the dojo wall.
Oh, God. I think what's put a lot of karate and martial arts into question with a lot of people was the birth of the UFC.
Yes.
And that kind of stuff, because it's a different style of fighting. It's totally different. And you've got to have your ground game. You've got to have your strikers and so on and so forth. And a lot of people going, you know, well, yeah, what you're doing doesn't work and so on. But and that's why I think I welcome all styles to the dojo, because as you said, if you go to ground, karate is not the be all and end all to defend yourself.
Right.
You know, and exactly. I've got a guy who's a Kyokushin style, they're basically toe to toe, bare fist, full contact, just no head contact, everything else goes. This guy is an absolute beast standing up. Put him on the ground and it's kind of, okay, I'm a turtle on my back, what do I do?
Exactly.
So, I mean, yes, I am always 100% behind the technical ethos and the traditional ethos of what has come from the Far East from thousands of years ago. But I do like a little bit of, okay, as you said, if something does happen as a byproduct, maybe we can learn a bit that will work in a street situation. And funny enough, we will do that as part of a Shodan grading. We will have katas, techniques, that goes on for the best part of 2 to 3 hours. And then we get into sparring, 1-on-1, 1-on-2, 1-on-3, 1-on-4, even to see how the guy fares out. But when all that is finished, what we do is we put someone in the middle of the floor and we put 4 attackers around them. One's got a plastic knife, which that's another night's conversation. I don't like knife defenses. Run, hit him with a chair and go.
Exactly.
You know, but just
here's
for
the purpose. Here's all my money. Just take it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just get that knife away from me.
Yeah. One's got a pretend stick. One guy's going to punch randomly. One guy's going to kick. And we stand them in the middle and say, okay, we're going to call 1, 2, 3, and 4 at the start. So, you know, number one's got a knife. Number two's got a club. And we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4 a few times. Then we'll call the numbers at random a few times. And then we'll go, okay, they're just going to come at you at random. They'll shout, right. Hey, and come. And it's just to see. When, okay, they're absolutely exhausted after a showdown grade.
Oh, of course.
Can you apply a little bit of what you've been working on all these years into a practical situation?
The way you just described that grading is exactly how the gradings I'm used to for showdown and higher, how they play out. All right, folks. You know what, Len? I think we're going to call it a day.
Thanks so much, Mitch. It's been great.
It's been awesome. Before we go, before I do my sign-off, is there any last words you'd like to say?
Oh, gosh. You might be sorry you said that. I'll be here for another hour.
Don't worry, there's an off button here. I'll just hit it.
Look, as you know, and this probably a chance of this are slim, but if anybody ends up in Ireland and they're out Dublin, West Wicklow way, there's always an open door, no matter what style, what age you are, to come and train. Most welcome. I mean, we're on our social media. Fight Fit Dojo is the social media page on Instagram and Facebook, but a shameless advertising there. More than welcome to come on. And if somebody can come to our club and share stuff with us from their style, I mean, you took a bit that night. We handed the reins over to you the evening you were training us. We're happy. We'd love to. Just give us knowledge. We'll give it back what we have. Give us what you have. And the more people we can spread that way, martial arts will survive for a hell of a lot better.
And I don't think we could end the podcast on a more optimistic and more applicable note. Thank you so much, Lenny.
Thanks, Mitch.
Folks, once again, this is the No Mind Podcast. Find us on our Facebook page or my personal Facebook page, or again, email us at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. My absolute respect and thanks to Len for coming on today, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much, folks.